Okay, great. Well, this is an opportunity for us to share some thoughts together. I do hope this is welcome. Welcome. Have you got the outline, or?
I do have the outline.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Do you need an outline?
Yeah. Have you got the outline in your book?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. So it's a privilege to have this time together. I hope that we will have an interactive time. I will certainly do some presentation first, and then we will be able to have a discussion on the basis of that. Maybe we should just focus our thoughts in prayer for a moment. Heavenly Father, we pray that you will give us a time of openness and reflection together on the basis of an important passage in your own word. Give us the listening hearts we need and the wisdom we need. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, the topic for this workshop, as you have seen, is biblical foundations and models for contemporary apologetics. And my friends keep teasing me about a certain chapter in the book of Acts, which I wrote my dissertation on. Oh, I'm going to speak on Acts, what is it? Acts 17? Again. But it's really a passage which occurs a number of times. But I think both in popular apologetic literature, but also in a number of other books and texts and so on. So we will look closely at that. But first, I think, to put it into a context, if you have the outline before you, just will follow it, sort of the major steps outlined there. But I would like to start where it says introduction, which is an appropriate place to start, I suppose. Really, it's two starting points. The first one is, how do we define apologetics? We haven't actually tackled that question so far in the conference, have we? We have just supposed that we have some kind of common understanding of apologetics. I'm not completely sure that we have. And I don't know if it matters that much. It has some consequences, but it's not the key thing. But it's still interesting, I think, to see what's going on. In the apologetics network sessions, we have focused on four objections. You know, yesterday was science. Today it was relativist, and tomorrow the problem of evil, and then the day after lifestyle objections. And of course, implicit is that it's an understanding that objections, the answering of objections, the dealing with objections, is a very important part of apologetics. That is an implicit understanding in the program then. But, come in. But, have you got the outline, by the way?
No.
So, there is it. But I think we may need to broaden our understanding of apologetics if you look at what is called defining there. What first of all is interesting to see that every belief and every worldview has its own apologists. Sometimes Christians are too afraid to use the word, we as Christians, to use the word apologetics. We think, oh, this is just, you know, example of arrogance on our behalf. No, it's not. Every belief, every worldview has its own apologists, its own apologetic traditions. That is true of Islam, that is true of Buddhism, that is true of Marxism, and so on. So it's actually a matter of identifying those traditions, identifying those apologists. Welcome. And it's a matter of seeing it. And I would like to suggest, and this is something we can come back on in the discussion, that a fruitful way of understanding apologetic is as I've outlined it here. Christian apologetic may be described as the rational justification of Christian truth claims. Let's take that part first. The rational, it has to do with content. It's not rationalistic, but it's rational. It has to do with a defined content. And justification, that relates to there is some truth that needs to be justified, some truth claims that needs to be justified. And that never happens in a vacuum. It's always over against. It's always over against. And this over against situation can be outlined in terms of three different dimensions. One is what we just mentioned, objections. So it means that objections have to be met, the key objections. But it's also concerning questions. You know, the wonderful phrase from Francis Schaeffer said, honest answers to honest questions. And then thirdly, alternatives. To use the expression of Nick Pollard at the Maurice Trust, the positive deconstruction of alternative worldviews. So I think it's all these things that is included in apologetics. So apologetics may be sometimes understood just as defense, but it's more fruitfully understood as something which includes both engaging questions, engaging objections, and engaging alternatives. But why do we do that? Why do we do this? Well, I think it's a dual aim. One, in order to establish what I've called the epistemic permission. That is, that we are within our epistemic rights, within our rights as rational beings, as made in the image of God, to be Christians. To confess the Christian faith, to be a Christian, is not to start with a handicap compared with the atheist. It means that we actually, it's a legitimate position. And you may be familiar with the work of Alvin Plantinga, who has especially focused on this and made, I think, a wonderful inroad into today's society by actually emphasizing that as Christians, we don't start with a handicap. We are on a par level with other worldviews. But it goes beyond that. It goes also to the epistemic obligation. Confer what Paul is saying in Romans 1. There is no excuse. So it's actually a matter of we as Christians saying that there is not, it's not a number of possible answers to whether Jesus rose from the dead, for example. It's actually one answer and one explanation which makes sense. So, and then the last part of the definition is then it's both for Christians and for non-Christians. Again, this is a matter of debate, but I think that's the most helpful way of describing it. It's both for nurturing Christians' faith, and it's for reaching out in evangelism. And some apologists and some apologetic ministries emphasize the one, and some emphasize the others. I think we need both in a healthy balance. I don't know if you have ever read apologetic textbooks with one question in mind. How much is said about the Bible? I actually did that some 10 years or more back, and I was quite struck by the lack of serious engagement with biblical material in so many textbooks. Let me use one textbook as an example, not because it's worse than anyone else, but it's symptomatic, I'm afraid, of many textbooks. That is the magnificent, in many ways, textbook by Alistair McGrath called Bridge Building, where he comes to, how many of you have read that? So you're familiar with, some of you. It's a British textbook, UK textbook, and published in US under another title, I think. Why Intellectuals Need God or something. I think it's something like that. Wonderful title. It reminds me of how one of Francis Schaeffer's book was translated into Norwegian. The Schaeffer's original title of one of the book was Death in the City. But to make that work in a pietistic Norwegian environment, how was the translation? It was, I am not ashamed of the gospel. Can you imagine the kind of tension, cultural tensions there? So of course, that was the positive content. That was the positive message. But it was nothing of the emphasis on the law, as it were, you know, death in the city on from Jeremiah, Lamentations and so on. Anyway, when I made Alistair McGrath's book a special test case, and it was interesting to see that the Bible did not constitute a foundation for apologetics, but just some illustrations on the way to it. So I think there is, come in. I think there is a need to go deep into this. And this is an area which really I think many of you also, if you're interested, could go into and could try to discover more about. It's a fascinating area. And interesting to see then, if we take this understanding of apologetics and apply it then to the Bible, this means that how do we then identify apologetic models or apologetic material? Yes, well, by looking at where do we find engagements with questions, where do we find engagements with objections, and where do we find engagements with alternatives? That's where we need to look at. And I just outlined some examples. Over again, specific questions. Well, think about the ministry of Jesus. How many questions he engaged in answering, and also how many questions he asked, sort of returned the questions. The Gospel of John, as you know, is a series of examples there. And we don't have time to go into that, but that's a fascinating study in itself to see how Jesus did that. And the apostles as well. They never ignored the questions. They always took the questions seriously. And I think, again, Francis Schaeffer's catchphrase, as it were, honest answers to honest questions, is a very important one. Secondly then, on next page, over again specific objections. We find clearly that a number of people had specific objections to the Christian faith. In 1 Corinthians, we read about that the first Christians confessed one God and one Lord. And of course, this is an example where they encountered a number of objections from people who had their own worldviews. And the way they expressed their worldviews became visible in a way in the objections to the Christian faith. And have you ever read and thought about Acts 26? Paul is answering to an objection. Your great learning has driven you insane. I'm sure you remember the passage. And how did Paul answer that? Well, that's a very interesting example of an apologetic approach. He very clearly, if you look at it, he talked about that this is, I'm not insane. What I'm saying to you is well thought out. It's consistent. It's actually something which is, to use the truth criteria, it's consistent, coherent. Secondly, it did not happen in a corner, in a forgotten little place where no one could check it out. It happened in history. And as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, well, some of the witnesses are still alive. That's the kind of approach Paul has. And then, you know, the response to Paul then, well, you almost convinced me of the truth. So it's a kind of almost pragmatic understanding of truth as well, in terms of the truth bringing people to conversion, the need for a choice. This brings us to, over again, specific alternatives. And I think we do need to read the Bible in light of that most of the passages or the books were written in pluralistic contexts. They were written either explicitly or implicitly over against competing faiths, competing worldviews. Just take one example. We heard yesterday from the Bible exposition from Genesis 3. And think about Genesis 1, which Don alluded to in his exposition today. In cultures where the sun, the moon, the stars were considered as divine in one sense or another, it's certainly a dethronization of those deities, so-called deities, by saying that God created those. And you know, we need to read the Bible to understand, I think, that there's always a worldview fight, a worldview contest going on. And I think this opens up the Bible in a wonderful sense of the world. And I've given you a quote of what F.F. Bruce says about the book of Acts. Of the three main types of Christian apologetics in the second century, Luke provides first century prototypes. First, apologetic in relation to pagan religion, that is, Christianity is true, paganism is false. Secondly, apologetic in relation to Judaism. Christianity represents the fulfillment of true Judaism. And thirdly, apologetic in relation to the political authorities. Christianity is innocent of any offense against Roman law. So what is actually Bruce saying here? He's saying that when you look at the book of Acts, you find a number of examples of the apostles engaging with alternative worldviews. And that is actually picked up later by, in the second, the third, the fourth century, by people, you know, persons like Justin Martyr and others, who then develop this process, this way of thinking. And when you look at the book of Acts, it really makes sense as an apologetic book in its entirety. And it's interesting, among commentators, biblical commentators, this is a growing concern when they read the text. A number of people have suggested for the last 10 or 15 years that it's actually meant to be read as an apologetic. Not as an apologetic over against non-Christians, but as an apologetic for Christians. As I've written down here on the notes, with a dual intention to provide them both with confirmation of the truth of their Christian faith and with apologetic tools and models for reaching outsiders. So it's a confirmation of their faith. So they needed to be confirmed. They needed to be strengthened over against paganism, over against the Jewish faith, over against the challenges from the Roman Empire, the whole context there. So actually, it makes sense to read the book of Acts as a strengthening of faith book, as a confirmation of their faith, of the truth of their faith. But then also as something which goes beyond that. So if you want to put it this way, it's like three layers. The first, and sort of the one which is immediately visible, is the historical intention to actually to write a story of the first Christian church. You know, it was to write about how the gospel got from Jerusalem and out to the Roman Empire. That's the sort of the first level. It's a book of the story of the church. But the second layer then is a confirmation. So on that route, sort of en route to Rome, the gospel met a number of alternative worldviews. And Paul then, and the others, that is Luke, in telling this story, is concerned about confirming their faith. And we must not underestimate, I think, the role of apologetics in confirming Christian believers' faith. That is a very important, which we talked about a bit earlier in relationship to the definition of apologetics. But then again, when confirming their faith, he's telling about, Luke is mentioning a number of instances, examples, case studies, if you want, where you see Paul and Peter and the others meeting other worldviews. And that is then, I think it makes it quite reasonable, quite plausible to look at those passages as models and tools designed by Luke on the basis of the apostolic experience, as tools and models intended for us as well. And we could also touch on that in the discussion time or reflection together afterwards maybe, but it's interesting also there are very clear links from the book of Acts to a number of important passages in the Pauline letters as well. We could come back to that. But when you look at a passage like Acts 17, which we have chosen to look at today, of course there are a number of principles that we need to look at. What do we need to have in mind? Well, this is a sketchy outline, so we're just sort of briefly looking at some important points. But I think, first of all, we need to be very aware of what kind of text are we looking at. What is the actual genre of the text? Is it an Old Testament or a New Testament passage? Is it a narrative? Well, this is certainly a narrative. And it's a speech, you know, it's a recorded speech within a narrative, again. So in that sense, it's a didactic within a narrative. And it's certainly not a poetic text, even though Paul quotes some poetic material, but that's another thing. Secondly, what kind of context? We need to identify what are the questions being asked, what are the objections, and what are the alternatives? Well, we'll come back to that. And then it's also profitable to ask, are there any comparable contexts today when we move from the then to the now? And secondly, if we find the content, identify the content there, is it considered in, should it be considered in terms of a normative worldview content? That is something which is binding for us today. Or should it be considered in terms of an approach which may be recommended? Or is it something which is repeatable? Or is it even something which is negative? I mean, that's the whole spectrum of options are open for us. And maybe we should just briefly start with the possibility of D there. Because some people interpret Act 17 as a negative model. And they have this reading, you may have come across this, on the basis of 1 Corinthians 2, 1 to 5. They have this understanding that Paul actually had been in Athens and he had tried the intellectual way, and then he came to Corinth and understood that he needed to actually to choose a spiritual way of doing it. Well, John Stott has presented a wonderful argument against this in a number of books. The Contemporary Christian, I think, is one of the places where you can find it. And he says that it makes sense to look at it in terms of Paul in 1 Corinthians 2 expressing how he looked forward to the extremely challenging context in Corinth. And he's not talking about changing his attitude in Athens, but actually talking about forward, how difficult it is, morally, spiritually, politically. You can almost think of any kind of challenging thing, and he would encounter that in Corinth. And of course, when he came to Corinth, he reasoned and argued and persuaded as well. So it's not a valid argument when you look into it, but it still pops up often in Christian circles, in conservative circles. People feel a bit uncertain about this passage in Act 17, since it's so argumentative. And I think the important thing is not, in a way, the actual context. We must not think that this only is a model for intellectuals, I think. It goes much deeper. It's a model for how to encounter any context. So it goes, you know, underneath the actual example and case study we can find. There are principles there that can be uncovered, that can be applied again today. So I think when we look at the different elements in the text, we'll find that there are both normative worldview elements, there are recommendable approaches, and there are patterns that may be repeated. This brings us then to the text itself. And let's take time to read through the text. Act 17, 16 to 34. David, would you mind reading for us? Yeah.
Act 17 and verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship is something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead." When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others.
Thank you. Well, you know, where from the Damaris Trust has got its name, didn't you? From verse 34. Well, this is a fascinating passage, isn't it? I must say that I read it a couple of times, but I'm still fascinated by it. It really, you know, it grips the imagination. Paul encountering a city which still, you know, it wasn't mighty at all at that time. It was maybe 10 or 15,000 people living there, maybe 20,000. It lived on its proud heritage. But it was still considered as a place of a great symbolic power in terms of a city of learning, a city of the great philosophers and so on. So I think it's actually the first encounter between Christianity and Hellenistic philosophy, as it were. So let's look at 10 elements from the passage. And as you can imagine, we won't be able to go into all 10 of them in depth, but we can just indicate some important points here. The first point, I think, is quite clearly that Paul is decisively steeped here. He's sort of certainly he's gripped by the Christian worldview, and what he presents is something both concerning God's nature and concerning God's revelation. I think that's the two key things here: God's nature and God's revelation. He has a deep understanding of God's nature as God both being transcendent and immanent. That is a theme that runs through the whole passage. God is beyond the world, he's transcendent, and he is, you know, a living presence within the world at the same time, upholding the world, sustaining the world. So that's one aspect. Dimension, God's nature, in the two aspects of that, God as transcendent and immanent. So Paul had a deep understanding of that. That gave him a tool for understanding the worldviews he met. We'll come back to that. Secondly, Paul had an understanding of God's revelation. That God's revelation both could be expressed in what we would call general revelation and special revelation. So God had revealed himself both in a general way and in a specific way. This is comes quite clearly out, you know, it comes out quite clearly in the passage as a whole, that that is what actually Paul is concerned with. Think of verse 17. It actually says in that Paul reasoned in the synagogue, and then verse 18. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. That was a wonderful summary, wasn't it, of Paul's message, Jesus and the resurrection. And I sometimes think, would it be quite a rewarding thing if our preaching was summarized in the same way? But then again, it seems as if Paul almost underestimated the perceptions of people in that context. When you think of how they perceive this, because look at verse 17 again, and 18, maybe rather verse 18. He seems to be advocating foreign gods. So Paul had not managed to get across that Jesus and the resurrection was set within a monotheistic worldview. So it seems as if he started with Jesus, the cross, the resurrection. And that, of course, didn't make any sense without the framework of the whole biblical worldview. So that was what I intended, you know, with my number two feature here. Luke probably describes Paul as an apologist who gradually sees the need for a proactive approach in agora contexts. That means he seems to have had more like a reactive approach in the first place, but then understood, oh, this is a context where I really need to think back. And I think it seems as if he was struggling, how can I communicate the Christian faith in a way which makes sense with the audience? And it seems as if he then started to think about what he had learned about Jewish history, about the Old Testament. And one Swedish New Testament theologian, Bertil Gärtner, has suggested that actually Paul here links back to the Jewish apologists, Hellenistic apologists in the second century, first century and second century before Christ. Those who needed to, well, they had met something of the same challenge because they had went out into the, you know, the Roman world or the whole Hellenized world and needed to communicate their belief in one God into such a context. So he actually found a resource there. So that is a fascinating thing to think about. And when I say agora context, agora, of course, is the Greek word for marketplace. So this is, then you can use it as an all-embracing concept for a pluralistic marketplace context. That is how I've found it useful to put it in this way. And then thirdly, Luke clearly here describes Paul as someone who has a contextual understanding, who understands the context. Gradually, yes, but still, he has a contextual understanding. What are the objections, the alternatives, the questions? Well, let's look at the questions first. You can see, can we hear more about that? That's a clear question, isn't it? In verse 19 and 20. And then again, in the implicit question in verse 18, who is this Jesus and who is this mysterious resurrection? Because they thought he was an idol, a god. and that Jesus was the male God and Anastasia was the female God. It was actually like a divine couple. So it's a fascinating thing that. And as well as yet another implicit question, and that is not visible from a surface reading of the text. But, you know, when you read, David, you read about the Areopagus Council. That, again, of course, is a whole question of interpretation, but it seems probable that what Paul actually encountered here was not a meeting on the hill itself, which was called, you know, the Areopagus Hill, but probably in the marketplace, in the Agora, where the Areopagus Council also met regularly. And their tasks were, they had a number of tasks, but one of their tasks, which has been shown very convincingly by Bruce Winter at Tyndale House in Cambridge, he has shown that one of the important tasks was actually to license new altars in the religious setting of the marketplace, to license or to question and to license the new heralds, the new preachers, if you want to put it that way, for foreign gods. So here is Paul then, and he is clearly seen as someone who is then coming from the outside to present a foreign god. So then, of course, the implicit question is there a need for a new altar? And do you know what was behind that? I'm sure it wasn't just a religious curiosity, but also commercial business. You know, another altar would bring money into the hands of the city. You know, into the council and the leading authorities. It would increase the religious commerce, as it were. So that is so the questions are: can we hear more about this? Who is Jesus and what is the resurrection? As well as the implicit, is there a need for a new altar? The objections then. Let's identify the objections. Well, it's a clear objection in verse 18. What is this babbler trying to say? This is really, what is this foolish person trying to say? The word there, spermologos, you know, is the word for foolish. Someone who picks up scraps of learning and just present them in an unsystematic way. And then further on, he's preaching foreign gods. By some, this was seen as something which wasn't the thing to do, because Athens was so proud. You know, Athens was so proud of its store history, so proud of its culture, of its gods. So anything that wasn't genuinely Athenian was considered by some as anathema, something to be rejected. And again, something which isn't maybe visible from a surface reading of the text. But behind this whole story, there are a number of important traditions. Paul is sort of tapping into ancient traditions. One of them is a story about an ancient plague that hit Athens some 100 years before Christ. And to be sure that they really safeguarded themselves, they actually erected a number of they were convinced that this hit the city due to the divine or the god's wrath. So they needed to please the gods. So they then obviously went the whole circle around with all the different altars, all the gods. But they wanted to be sure. What if they have forgotten a god or two? So they erected, so the story says at least, they erected altars to unknown gods, just to be sure, you know, to safeguard themselves. So that's a kind of a safety insurance, religious safety insurance, which they actually... So the implicit objection then, if we are wrong, why is there no plague today? So if we are wrong, you know, that's the kind of attitude towards Paul. If we are wrong, why haven't the gods or this unknown god or whatever hit us, killed us, destroyed us? Why are we still alive? And that, of course, is a wonderful way into the topic of judgment, which is very visible in Paul's presentation. And I'm sure you recognize the alternative worldviews. Of course, Stoicism, of course, Epicureanism, and of course, popular religion as well, popular Athenian religion. And if we move on to Paul's awareness of an ability to apply appropriate justification procedures, I find that fascinating. Because Paul understood, gradually it seems, that it was no use to use the Old Testament as sort of a common authority. It didn't make sense. So he starts from creation, which they all shared, and did not start from the Old Testament. Because the people he met, they had no knowledge of the Old Testament, and they did not consider the Old Testament scriptures as authoritative. It does not mean that the Old Testament did not inform Paul. When you look at the passage, there are a number of important background passages from the Old Testament that informed Paul. Not the least, Isaiah 40, 41, 42, 43, which is set in the context of the God and the gods, the one and true God and the gods, the idolatry. A very important passage as a background. And then fifthly, Luke describes Paul as someone who starts with the beliefs of the Athenians and positively deconstructs these beliefs. I mentioned the immanence of God and the transcendence of God. And I think this is a key thing to understand the whole passage, because Paul seems simultaneously to affirm both Stoicism and Epicureanism as half-truths. Because Stoicism was in some way correct. They had Stoicism, you know, had understood something about God's immanence, whereas Epicureanism had understood something of God's transcendence. So Paul seems simultaneously to affirm both Epicureanism and Stoicism. And this goes back as half-truths. But then, of course, on the other hand, so if he then affirmed Stoicism, he at the same time rejected Epicureanism and vice versa. So it's a very interesting thing going on, a very creative way of communicating. It's like, you know, having on the one hand a deistic religious attitude of today's world, which could remind us of Epicureanism, for example, and the new religious or pantheistic or Eastern whatever religious attitudes of today, which could remind one of Stoicism, and those two being affirmed as the one as being true in one area and the one as being true in an opposite area. But the Christian faith explains both areas. That's actually one of the most fascinating aspects, I think, of this text. How Paul's understanding of who God is helps him to encounter other worldviews. Because other worldviews are never completely wrong. Sometimes we might have this impression in Christian apologetics, reading some literature, that we are so eager to criticize other worldviews that we don't take time to affirm what is actually true there. It's always something to affirm. It's always something to say, to realize there is something that is true here. And we could come back to that and to discuss the applications of that for today's world. And then when you look at the next 6, 7, 8, and 9 points, they belong together because they all describe the argument. What is the What is the moves that Paul are making here? Well, I've expressed it as in a summary point in number 6. Paul starts with the credibility of a Judeo-Christian understanding of who God is. So Paul starts with a Judeo-Christian understanding of who God is, moves then to the God's authority, and then thirdly, to God's revelation in Jesus Christ. And the first, you know, it's like the first part, what I've called number 7 here, the first part of the argument, it takes a number of verses, whereas the second part of the argument, or the second argument, is more compressed. And then the third argument is very, very compressed. So we're actually moving from a lot of details to a very compressed argument, the third one. So let's start with this natural theology argument. If you turn to the final part of the outline, I've just written down a definition of natural theology, which is from Bill Craig. He says, I think it's well put, "General revelation is the traits of the author reflected in his product, the fingerprint of the potter in the clay, so to speak, whereas the arguments of natural theology are the human products of men's rational reflection upon general revelation." So the point is that when we talk about natural theology, it's then the human products of men's rational reflection on the basis of general revelation. It means that all of humanity, every human being, is reflecting either consciously or unconsciously on the basis of the traits, the traces left in creation. And that is then more or less credible, what people then reflect, their reflections. So the interesting thing is that Paul says that whereas natural theology such as Stoicism and Epicureanism contain elements of truth, we have talked about that already, a Judeo-Christian natural theology provides the most adequate view of God, the universe, and humanity. And this is,
What do you mean under natural theology?
Yes.
Some Augustine approach that we can find out that it God ourselves, mm-hmm. or we just speaking about general revelation?
No, we're talking about that God has revealed himself, that is general revelation. And on the basis of that, we can discover something of what God has revealed to himself. So that is how I use natural revelation. Of course, I'm not talking about it in a Thomistic sense, that we can find it. I'm not saying that Thomas necessarily meant this, but it seems as if at least some interpret him this way, that natural theology is something apart from revealed theology. So this is actually saying that God has laid the groundwork and we are discovering something of this. So that was what I mean. So different people, all of us, discover something. And there is always some truth in that, as I said, because it's based on God's revealed truth in the general revelation area. But then a Judeo-Christian natural theology, I've written here, provides the most adequate view of God, the universe, and humanity. And I find it so fascinating that, I mean, this can be expressed on so many levels. It can be expressed on a philosophical level, like the traditional arguments. I don't like the word proofs for the existence of God, because there are only mathematical proofs. It's only arguments we're talking about. But there is a whole renaissance of those arguments. And one of them, of course, is one of the key spokes, the key people here is Bill Craig, who have done a great job in reviving the old cosmological argument, saying that it actually is a strong argument, not 100% argument, but it's a strong argument. And we must not be, I think, be deceived by the Enlightenment critique to this, but understand that when we rephrase it, not in absolute terms, but in probability terms, it's actually quite strong, those arguments. That's one level, but it's also a popular level. You know, And that's actually what we find, like in Psalm 19, talking about the, you know, the fingerprints of God's creation being visible. That's the more indirect, if you want, the more soft approach. So I think there's a place for the whole spectrum here of both philosophy and the popular approaches. We're talking about an adequate view of God, the universe, and humanity. And what is that? That is a worldview, of course. We're talking about then a whole worldview. Secondly, the second argument here, which I've put under number 8, is something which Don Carson referred to in his presentation today, in his exposition. He talked about that the concept of man's responsibility is grounded in man, in men and women being made in the image of God. That is, responsibility is a response to the divine creator. So therefore, it's a claim here, it's a very strong claim in the text that God has ultimate authority, as expressed in the claims about his final judgment. And the point from Don's exposition today, this argument, this claim then, is plausible, since God is the creator and sustainer. It makes sense that someone who's created by God, the one who created us, has authority over us. And think about the word authority. It has to do with author. The author of life has authority over us. That is the only legitimate authority, the only legitimate absolute authority. And of course, this constitutes an appropriate basis for claims about the epistemic obligation of the Christian faith as well, which we talked about earlier. So among all those pictures, the different worldviews in the world, only the Christian worldview gives a true picture of God, the universe, and humanity. An adequate picture. And if that is adequate, that constitutes a basis for human responsibility, for that God, as author of life, has authority over us. But God is not the unknown God. He moves to us. He has shown us his face and he's given us his name. Again, we are very close to John 1, aren't we? John 1:18, that God has, that in Jesus, God has shown himself. Don didn't mention that, but it's actually God has, I think it's exegesato, I think that's the word used there. God has actually shown himself clearly in Jesus Christ. And I think we must not belittle the focus on the resurrection here. And I've written three important dimensions here, written down that. First, the resurrection is important because it deals with ultimate human concerns. It deals with death, the fear of death. That is something which is so prevalent today, the fear of death. And it has followed humanity through the ages, of course. We all feel that fear more or less in certain circumstances. And secondly, the resurrection of Jesus is in the New Testament linked to the uniqueness and authority of Jesus. The resurrection indicates that Jesus is unique and that he has authority. And thirdly, it's being based on sufficient available evidence. There's a very strong expression in verse 31. He has given proof, it says in this version here, of this to all men. The word used is pistis. And we must be careful when we read the theological dictionaries and so on, because some of them were written by existential theologians who did not want to see the facticity of this. So you find Bultmann and the likes who have commented on some of these in the theological dictionaries. And Colin Hemer, a late caller of Tyndale House, has shown very convincingly that pistis here means, which is the Greek word for faith, of course, which means what is secure, what is actually stable. And that is very important. Let me then round up by emphasizing number 10 as well. What was what were the aims here? Why did Paul then, what did Paul have in mind? What did he want to achieve? What was his aim? Well, I think it's very interesting. Some commentators, some apologists, some communicators emphasize only the bridge-building aspect of this passage, whereas others emphasize only the confrontational aspects of this passage. But actually, the passage contains both. We must not minimize, reduce one or the other. The passage this explains as a whole. So at one level, it is the aim is to arouse interest, to elicit questions, you know, new questions, more fruitful questions. And one Norwegian New Testament theologian has suggested that Paul actually models Socrates here, because and there was actually in the Greek rhetorical handbooks there were instructions: if you met an audience which was characterized both with curiosity and criticism, you needed to go in an indirect way. And this explains maybe this theologian says why Paul introduces Jesus at the end in an indirect, almost cryptic way. You know, he doesn't even mention the name Jesus. So this might be a strategy to catch the attention of the audience. Who is this man? And they have misunderstood Jesus before, you know, as one of the divine couple, as I said. So now Jesus is being reintroduced in the setting of a monotheistic worldview. So it was certainly to arise interest and elicit questions. Secondly, to persuade. And some people were persuaded. Some people came to believe, came to faith. And thirdly, to confront. And it's clearly that Paul did confront. He hit some targets in the hearts of the people there. Let's look at verse 32. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said. In the Greek, it's hoi men, hoi de. On the one hand, on the other hand. It's very clearly expressed here from Luke's side how actually it's intended from the author here to express it's a dual reaction. Some sneered because they felt this didn't meet their demands of a faith that was sort of Athenian for them, whereas others were interested and said, we want to hear more about this. And then some came to belief. I want to skip the final passage, the final part of you could read that on your own. I'm just saying that I think this is relevant today. Maybe we need to complement Paul's arguments. We need to develop some of that. And if you want to read more about that, you can click in on damaris.org. And January this year, a Whitfield briefing paper I wrote on encountering and engaging a postmodern context, applying the apologetic model in Acts 17 is published there. So if you want to do that, you're welcome. So I think maybe we should use some time for discussion, for questions. As you can understand, this is just scratching the surface here, but it's still suggesting ways. And my point, I think my basic point is this. This is not the only passage in the New Testament that is important, but it's representative of a number of other passages. And it shouldn't be considered as only a model for intellectuals. It goes much deeper. It's a model for encountering a context of pluralism, a context of questions, objections, alternatives, in a proactive way. Okay. So let's open up for questions, clarifications. You might disagree. You're welcome to do that if you want. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Agree that we deal in this passage exactly the situation we have now in Europe, and I believe that main problem for church in Europe now that we separated apologetics and evangelism. We make evangelism only proclamation. We just proclaim whether you buy it or not. But evangelism, the goal of evangelism is conversion. And what is conversion? It's change of mind, change of worldview. And so this is apologetics. We should communicate our the truth we know, the way people can understand it, to change their mindset. And the result we see in the Europe is a decline of the church is only because church became an apologetics. And you see, if we
come on,
why this specific passage so much important? Because on the way of changing worldview of the person compared to the biblical standards is gradual. It's not one. And the Bible, for instance, says that we preach Christ crucified for Jews stumbling block, for Gentile foolishness. And we see in passage we mentioned in Act 26 that two intelligent person, cream de la cream of society, Festus and Agrippa, hears the same message. And Festus says, you're out of the mind, I can't understand that, the thing. And what Paul says, it's okay, I'm talking not to you right now. It's fine, I am talking to the king, and he knows what I'm talking about, I'm your majesty. Yeah, and so one is Jew, by their worldview, and another is Gentile. And so worldview has room for Supreme God. Gentile, he is Supreme God. All the gods he creates is actually his tools to manipulate the deities, because he is the center of his lifestyle. And actually, speaking about the argument, Paul, we can trace all argument to the classical apologetical argument, and all classical apologetical argument we can finally trace to the ontological argument. And actually, Paul here used ontological argument. He speaks, he uses the concept of God. And God as a supreme being. And he speaks, you know, all these gods, I'm preaching there is a God who creates ourselves. That is why gods we create cannot be the God, because it will be contradictions, because God is supreme. So it's not an ontological argument, but he contextualized it for the audience. And so if, like, pagans, Gentiles, Jews, you see, like, I don't speak about Jews nation, I speak about Jews. And Christianity. Each stage is actually a complete change of worldview. Here I am the center of the life. Here we speak about God. Here we know how we can come to Him. And what Paul actually does in this speech, and we see that when Paul speaks to Jews, his development of argument don't differ from arguments Peter used when speaking to the Jews. And he's not, again, just proclaiming the message. He proves. He tells, you know, there is no other answer. The very Jesus who killed is the Messiah. Everything, everybody is free, dismissed. And they say, well, what should we do now? Then only he proclaims the message. So when Paul and Peter speaking to Jews, they want going to convert them from one level, this level to this level. What is specific about situation in Act 17? This is the level, and our cultures became more pagan now. They're not considered the one God. And I believe that he doesn't even mention Jesus on this level, because this is foolishness for them. The preaching of Christ crucified is foolishness for Gentiles. And every time apostles or Jesus speak to people, he speaks exactly on the level they can comprehend and take them as far as they can. And at the end, he mentioned Jesus. You know, He already told about some authors who speak negatively about this Paul's position, because we don't know how many converts. Actually, we know that at least four, Dionysus, Damar, and others, come to here, to become Christians. But you see, when on Pentecost, converts convert from Jews to Christians, so we can know how many convert by their baptism. But here, we don't know. It's a process. It can go slowly, it can go faster, but it has no external way to know how. We know that at least four was smart enough to find out where it goes to. Yeah, but how many was taken from this stage to another stage so he can go further with them? We don't know. So this is this passage, I agree, that extremely important, especially for contemporary European context.
Thank you, Sergei. That was very helpful, I think. I think that expresses in a diagram a lot of things we have been talking about. I think that you're very right in emphasizing that we have made a split between evangelism and apologetics. And of course, in the New Testament, conversion is a very many-faceted thing. You know, it means sometimes, you know, turning from guilt to forgiveness, turning around in the repentance kind of way, whereas conversion in other sense, it means changing of mind. And we need both. One is sort of the moral aspect, and one is the intellectual aspect, if you want to put it that way. But I think you're very right in what is, I think what is striking, in addition to what you said, is that Paul actually affirms truth here. You know, that I think, I find it so fascinating. Paul is actually affirming Stoics in one area, Epicureans in other areas. And Paul is also, so he, in a way, he says that, and of course, C.S. Lewis talks about, you know, the pagan myths. And there is something here which is interesting in that area, but that is another subject. Yes? I think, well, it's we don't know, of course. I mean, so we need to respect when we're talking about we're speculating. It's not there, so we can make more or less probable conjectures on the basis of that. I think one possible explanation would be that this is not a church setting. It's not a Jewish setting. So the whole idea of atonement and so on maybe something that comes on the way to become, you know, they wanted to know more. And then Paul obviously talked to them. That is the appropriate context then to talk about the cross, maybe. Yes, so maybe that's not the right. It might be that he actually mentioned, some say that he mentioned the cross. John Stott, for example, I quoted him before, says we have just the outline. If Paul mentioned the resurrection, he also mentioned the cross, maybe. We don't know, but at least in terms of the argument, he didn't have to mention the cross. I think if you look at my argument there, the three parts there, it makes perfect sense without the cross, because this was not the point. It was preparing the way, if you were, put it this way. It was a pre-evangelistic. So I don't like the, you know, people talk about Paul's sermon in Athens. I don't think it's a sermon. It's a follow-up speech. Paul preached in the Agora. We talked about that in verse 18. He preached about Jesus and the resurrection. That was, you know, open-air preaching, if you not to have all the connotations we think about in that respect. But I think that's so he clarified things over against, you know, questions, objections, alternatives. And in that follow-up speech, obviously, he didn't have to mention the cross. That is my view, I think, to make it sense. It doesn't mean that he didn't consider the cross that crucially important. You know, Paul in Acts, in 1 Corinthians 2, really talks about how important the cross is. And I'm sure that when they heard more, it was maybe Paul majored on the cross then. That was maybe for a number of sessions, you know, but we don't have that. Chris? Yeah, you had him. No, okay. Other comments?
If not, I don't want to monopolize time, but talking about Agora, you see, recently I have a very interesting discussion with one person who is in quite a well-known mission organization where he's called completely against using internet vacations with some reasons of it. And so the result will come out that the old model is to use internet. See, reaching in Agora is not meaning in our context, it's not reaching at the supermarket. Ancient market, like even today, some Oriental countries, is not only place for trade, but place for
escape. That's right, that's right.
So, internet is our Agora for this, for our years.
It's a good example of that, yeah. So, yeah.
Just going back to the cross issue, I wonder how much. The message more concentrates on the resurrection, and sometimes we can miss all this gain for the lordship that Jesus declared by the resurrection.
That's right.
And I just wonder if that should impact our own manifesting of the world. Preaching more than we perhaps realize.
That's right.
Until we've got the resurrection sorted, we don't appreciate it.
Why should we listen to anything about the cross if Jesus didn't rise from the dead? So it's sort of opening up the door. So that's, I think, a fourth step would be the cross here. I mean, in my outline there from the text. I think it makes perfect sense to, I think it's well put by you there. Chris, now, come back.
Based on the first chapter of Matthew's Gospel. But I found myself, and there was nothing in it that I felt was doctrinally inaccurate, that I noticed anyway. But I found myself wondering whether some of the people who had been hearing, who had been students, might have heard a Jesus who was, in a sense, a solution to their personal problems of guilt feelings, and or conceivably, although I think probably not in this case, whether if you just preach the cross without the resurrection and the lordship, you turn it on their heads. It's my decision to follow Jesus as opposed to his command that I should follow him. And if those things were there at all, they would only have been there possibly in my confused mind. But I just wondered what you've got here, in a sense, both by setting the person of Jesus in the context of exploring our creaturehood and God's creatorship, and then the resurrection, then the lordship of Christ. In a sense, it puts the focus of my problems and how I solve them, and in a sense, helpfully humbles us before we get on to what is
right. And adding on the top of that also, I think, following on from what you're saying, there is a very strong message of sin in the passage. So, you know, it's very strong on the need for the cross. You know, if you look at verse, let's see, 27, I think it is, verse 27 says, God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. it's actually, you know, it describes the vertical dimension of God's creation. You know, it's two. We are created to seek God. It's God's initiative. And perhaps reach out for Him. It's a weak translation. It actually means groping in around in darkness. And then there is a and to find Him. Actually, to find Him there is weakened with a tense used, because it's almost impossible to find Him. You know, it's possible in principle, but impossible in practice, as it were. So due to sin. So the message there is clearly, we are groping around in darkness. That's the message there. So as Christians, we have this message about the need for the cross, which is based, of course, in God being the Creator, the Holy One, and God's holiness, which comes very, very strongly across here, and our sinfulness, our darkness in His eyes. So we are actually very close to John 1, I think, in many aspects about light and life, which Don talked about this morning. The only thing that is missing is the actual mentioning of the cross. Otherwise, all the other elements are there to build up here. But I think it's important not to misunderstand the intention of this passage. It's a follow-up clarification. The same thing happened in Lystra. We don't have recorded, neither in Lystra nor in Athens, the original presentations. Just, you know, in chapter 14, just the follow-up clarifications after the objections and so on. And that's interesting. So there is nowhere in Acts we have a missionary primer, as it were. That is not provided for us by Luke. I don't know why, but that's the case. And maybe could add also that there are very clear links from this passage to 1 Thessalonians 1, 9 and 10, about, you know, turning around from empty idols to the living and true God and so on, and wait for Jesus rose from the dead. And then, of course, there are very clear links also to 1 Corinthians 9, Jew for Jews, and, well, for those who are without the law, to become as someone who is without the law, and so on. I think maybe we need to close in terms of timing.
Very brief phrase. So you see, it doesn't mention cross, with which we use the title, but it mentions judgment, with you, which we use the term. Yeah.
That's a very interesting point. And there are so many things we could talk about. Also, I mean, the role of this altar to an unknown God. We talked about the judgment. You know, Paul alludes to this plague. But it's also, Paul is alluding to Socrates. And you know, if he affirms their worship at this altar to one unknown God, then all the other altars are false. You see? So actually, by affirming one, he actually introduces the critique of the other religions, the other altars. And that is what Socrates did, wasn't it? So again, Paul is affirming the truth of Socratic, the whole tradition of critique of religion. So we've just scratched the surface. But we would encourage you to do one thing, to always, when you're reading the Bible, to look out for, are there any objections that are being met? Are there any alternatives that are read that we can see over against, Christian faith over against? And are there any questions that are being answered? And I think that's where we find the apologetic material in the Bible. Thank you.